Blog Talk Radio.
Is Bitcoin or the technology that enables it a key to empowerment and freedom? Tonight's special guest says the answer to that question is yes.
Many people sense that something is wrong, like a dull ache just below the surface. The American dream doesn't seem to be working anymore. Not everyone gets a house with a white picket fence, a chicken in every pot, and more successful children. Are you working hard but can't make ends meet, even with two incomes? Do you see the steady rise in homelessness, hunger, and stagnation despite the official statistics? Has chasing the American dream led to piles of debt and a rat race for jobs without meaning? Enough of this one-size-fits-all vision of happiness. The traditional worldviews simply don't have the frame of reference that can describe, much less understand, what's going on today. Those old frames of reference worked well enough for people old enough to remember World War II, but those default visions just don't cut it anymore. And traditional institutions like the media, schools, and government don't have anything better to offer either. It's time to jump to a new vision, a new American dream, because we are in a new era, a new age. The shift requires us to reimagine the way we work, play, grow, and interact with our surroundings. I call it the new economy. Instead of collecting more things, people will focus on awakening their full potential. That includes helping others and making sure that having enough is a sustainable lifestyle. Our vision has four pillars: health, sustainability, peace, and abundance. We make progress by focusing on projects that build up each pillar for a season: the summer of peace, the autumn of abundance, and so on. Everything seems to be in chaos because we are in the transition, several years into a multi-year shift, and the old systems are being overwhelmed. This show not only explores the new era and the transition, we engage with the solutionary doers and thinkers who are creating this next stage for the human race. Most important, we sketch out the blueprint for joining and thriving in the new economy. Don't get caught up in the drumbeat of tragedy that you hear in today's mass media. Jump on board and help us build the next level.
Back, everyone. It's the last day of January, and I'm really glad you came. I'm broadcasting from San Antonio, Texas today, and I hope you guys are having a great evening. Money is anything that is generally accepted as payment for goods and services and repayment of debts. The main uses of money are as a medium of exchange, a unit of account, and a store of value. Money was introduced to satisfy the requirement that all items exchanged must be comparable in some way. Aristotle. So tonight my guest is Andy Gonzalez, who I've known probably 3 or 4 years, and he wears a lot of hats. And that's pretty common for those of us in the new era. He's a law student that it never intends to practice. He's an entrepreneur. He's a podcaster. In fact, I consulted with him when I started planning to launch this show. It's his passion as a Bitcoin evangelist that brings us to our show. Let's dig into his thoughts about the past, present, and future of cryptocurrencies in general, and Bitcoin in particular. Hi, Andy. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great, Cliff. We somehow figured out the technical conundrum of two Google accounts in one night, and now we're here.
Yeah, leave it to two technologists to really take forever to get something as simple as an online connection going. So I wanted to start talking about the history. And we talked about, I think Aristotle pretty much covered what money is in the opening quote. it makes sense to drill a little bit deeper into the part about generally accepted as money, which leads us to the concept of trust. You want to kind of cover about how trust and money fit together?
Yeah. So it is a very broad topic, and I think it's broad because it's been around for such a long time. Money isn't a new invention. It isn't something that we came up with the last century. It's been with us for a couple thousands of years. In fact, our closest cousin, the chimpanzee, understands the concept of money, so much so that they even began interacting in the oldest human profession known to man. You can look that up to know what that is. But the concept of money is very old, and it is mainly built on the concept of trust. If two parties do not trust that the medium of exchange that they're going to interact with has any value, then no one's time is going to be spent for somebody else's whatever they argue is money if they don't both agree on that money's value. There has to be trust between two parties to use that that media of exchange, and that's only one of the
concepts I think might be good to build on is the fact that these the whole idea of trust introduced a third party. So when we had a store of value, money as a store of value, when it was something like gold, gold or silver particularly became too bulky. So people would put it in a warehouse and get warehouse receipts for it. And in fact, if you go back to ancient Egypt, they were doing it with wheat instead of gold. But it's the same concept. You get warehouse receipts, and those warehouse receipts in turn became units of exchange. But through most of the history of our civilization, those receipts became bills or folding money. In fact, through most of the history of the United States, a dollar represented 1/20th of an ounce of gold. So, but when we had the warehouse, the folks doing the warehouses began to game the system, so to speak, and we developed something called fractional reserve banking.
Yeah. But you hit on something good there. So you were touching on the dichotomy that is currency and money, right? These paper slips that represent the barley, oats, or whatever is being stored in a silo. These people couldn't be bothered to be wheelbarrowing wheat around to use as money. The same way that before you could not go to the market with a cow and hope to exchange it for anything because you'd have to cut it into pieces. So these receipts that you're referring to are they're more in line with the definition of currency. And this currency actually has many of the same attributes that money has, but the one missing feature that currency doesn't have and that we'll be touching on more is the store of value. If the material that you own is not a store of value, then it is not good for anything but a currency. And what I mean by that is if today everybody agrees that these pieces of paper are exchangeable for each other's time and efforts, that could be a currency. But if this material doesn't maintain its store of value over many years, the same way that, as you've mentioned, gold and silver have, then you're not looking at a money as much as you're looking at a currency. And that's the one misnomer that people miss a lot when they hold a dollar bill in their hands and they say, I've got some money. Well, no, you sure, if relative to the moment of the United States' inception of that dollar to today, I suppose it's a terrible form of money, but it is money. And it's a terrible form because the dollar, since its inception, at least this dollar, this iteration, it's been in circulation for about, I think, since 1916, it's around the 1910s. That's when this dollar that we use today has been in circulation. It's lost about 90% of its purchasing
1913.
Power. So there's that.
I know you want to talk about the Federal Reserve.
Oh, we'll get there. I won't.
We talked about the warehouse receipts, and as things grew more sophisticated, instead of just the warehouse receipts that changed hands, we began to have ledger accounts. And for those of you who think of checking, and particularly the old school checking where you write a check, the check itself is not really the value. It's the fact that the bank that you write the check against holds your money in a ledger entry and is willing to transfer it from your ledger entry to to the person you're paid the order of's ledger entry.
Yeah,
one of the
accounts,
things I found interesting about ledgers that I just learned recently was some of the oldest archaeological evidence of writing in existence were actually ledgers. They were for temple receipts of people who had given tithes to temples, and they were written down on clay tablets. And they were particularly used clay because it was soft and it could be washed off and the tablets could be reused. Well, if the building that tablet was in burned, the clay tablet then baked and the writing was hardened. And 3,000 or 4,000 years later, archaeologists could actually find it and study it. Now, our modern ledgers were really called two-column accounting, and that actually came from the Venetians and their shipbuilding. I'm not sure how important that is to our conversation, other than the fact it's of historical interest.
I think it's of huge importance, though. Ledgers, they are the foundation of our economic system. If we can't trust the banks to be holding immutable ledgers, in other words, if I can't tomorrow accept that the money that you gave me is going to be in my account, then economics, or rather our economy, couldn't work. Arguably, it's not working in some aspects, but at least the day after tomorrow, you should know that if you try to run your debit card at the HEB or something, for those of you outside of Texas, that's our version of grocery store. Anyway, yeah, you have to trust that the money's going to be in the account the next day, and that's all thanks to the ledger that's being verified by the bank.
Yeah, the vast majority of people trade with regional grocery stores. So in St. Louis, it's Shook's. Up in the Texas Panhandle, where I'm from, it's United. Down here, it's HEB. But yeah, you used an interesting word in reference to ledgers, debit and credit, like debit cards and credit cards. The very first thing they teach you in basic accounting is to forget everything that you think you know about debits and credits. All that a debit really means is it's an entry in the left-hand column of the ledger, and a credit is an entry in the right-hand column of the ledger. Then you have to memorize particular accounts, which ones an increase causes the left hand to increase and which one causes the right hand to increase. And once you have all that stuff memorized, you really understand basic accounting. Believe it or not. Now I am getting off. The whole concept of banking is that the ledger was controlled by some trusted entity, generally called a bank, and that the money is the fact that you have a debit balance. You have money if you have a debit balance in your account at the bank. It's that simple, in the current banking system. And you better make regular payments if you have a credit balance in the bank. Okay, so we've talked about how the banks have turned money into really a ledger system. And they've actually, you mentioned 1913. That's when the Federal Reserve was created, which allows something called fractional reserve banking, which allows them to take the money in the balances and lend it out. Still have the balances in the bank, and that's the basis of fractional reserve banking, so that if they have a dollar and they lend out 80 cents, that becomes a deposit in someone else's account, so then the banks have $1.80, and then they do that over and over until of the original dollar, they've managed to create $5 worth of entries in those ledgers. And I wanted to see what you thought
right.
about the whole concept of trust in light of this whole fractional banking system that I've just quickly described.
So when a bank lends money to another party after taking your initial $1, it has in a sense created money out of thin air, or currency, if you will, out of thin air. And what does that mean? Well, for you and me, who are working every day to earn our buck, that means that a bank can, with its own discretion, under its own discretion that is not, I believe that there is some regulation, but I'm sure it's minimal. And so with the bank's discretion, they can print more money out of thin air. And they don't necessarily print it, but like Cliff was mentioning, they merely put an additional debit into the ledger and just create more money basically out of nowhere. So they type it out and they allow this other, they allow this entity or this party that was seeking a loan to take now 80 cents out of the original dollar that was, let's just say Cliff had put into the bank for savings. So this bank is now allowed to give more money than what it originally had to this lendee. And if the person that had the money lent to them defaults on the loan, that money was essentially created, put into our economy, and then no interest was paid, or the principal was not paid. So in a sense, arguably, even if the principal is paid, this bank has still, in principle, sorry to use the word so much, it has in principle created money out of thin air. So we have trusted banks with these powers. This was something I wasn't privy to. I never learned that in third grade, fourth grade, or even college. I was merely just told that money was the end game. Coming out of college, I'd like to get a steady job and start earning this thing called money. And they didn't even get that right, because it's not necessarily money that we're earning, it's actually currency. This practice, in a sense, is showing us the true nature of the currency that we're exchanging between each other. When one entity can indiscriminately make more of it, and we have to trust them to decide when they should make more of it, because we also have to understand that they don't hand loans left and right. Unless, of course, we're referring to the 2008 financial disaster, where banks were just indiscriminately giving huge amounts of money to people that in no universal dimension could have ever paid off those loans. And I believe they were called
ninja loans.
Yeah, that's
probably true.
Is that right,
I'd always
Cliff?
Heard of called subprime loans. And I'll admit, I was one of those the beneficiaries of that. I actually closed 4 loans in one day. And it happened to be Halloween, by the way.
Wow.
But,
yeah, that's spooky. We want to give you the benefit of the doubt and assume
I ended
that
up
you were going to pay.
Actually,
those loans
I did. Back. I ended up, this is ancient history. I did end up paying all 4 of those loans back. But there were a lot of people who couldn't, and they just ended up going belly
right.
up.
Right. And what happens when you prop up an entire market with basically nothing beneath it in terms of money. If no one was ever going to pay for these houses, we ended up getting the financial collapse. I'd recommend watching The Big Short. That's a fantastic movie, and it more properly elucidates the disaster than
yes,
I could.
Yes, it does.
So.
Well, and I think the whole reason we've been spending so much time on on describing fractional reserve banking so the listeners get an idea of how bad fractional reserve banking is. It destroys the value of money. It actually ends up destroying the value of everything slowly. Destroying is probably not the right word. It erodes the value of everything because it does it over long periods of time, although sometimes faster than others.
Right.
The price of things in 2008, other than real estate, has about everything else has gone up. You know, a shopping cart at groceries at the grocery store probably costs between, you know, what used to cost $100 now costs $130 to $150. And this fractional reserve banking causes that to happen. So those of us in technology have been looking for a better way. And I think that one of the key, wouldn't you agree that one of the key things that needed to be resolved was, how do you create a medium of exchange that doesn't involve trust? In other words, that third party that can play silly games with things in the background while you're not paying attention.
The whole thing about Bitcoin, the misnomer, I think, is that there is no trust. That's what people in the Bitcoin space will say, is that this is a trustless technology allowing you to move money from one party to another. But there actually is trust. The thing is that the trust isn't being placed on a third party. It's not being placed in a central authority, be it a business entity or government entity. The trust is being put on the protocol. In other words, it's being put on mathematics. If you trust that 8 times 8 is 64, and I hope I did my math right in that instant, then you would trust that the Bitcoin algorithm, the Bitcoin protocol, works. And all it really is, so Bitcoin, to take one of the people I look up to in the space, Andreas Antonopoulos, he says that Bitcoin is actually several things. Primarily, it is, yes, it is a token, it is a currency or a money, if you will, and it's also the protocol, the network that runs, that underlies the token that is Bitcoin. So there's the Bitcoin with the big B that is the what is the blockchain, what is the entire system, the network of Bitcoin, and then there's the Bitcoin with the little b, which is the currency or the money. So where did Bitcoin come from? How did Bitcoin come to be? I'm sure many of you might have already heard of it. I'm surprised more and more that people out in the street, I am that guy that'll just ask a random person, hey, you know what Bitcoin is? And they'll sometimes look at me funny and say, no, but I'll take it. And that makes me smile. But then once I do tell them what it is, then they'll say they want nothing to do with it. And that's just some people. and that's because it's an interesting concept. It's money, but coming from a strange guy on the sidewalk. And as Cliff and I have been talking about, money has come to us in the form of these green paper bills. But now it's being introduced to us as a form of digital currency, digital money. And this currency actually came to us around 2008, which is shortly after the financial collapse. There is one person by the name of Satoshi Nakamoto who presented to a bunch of techno, they called themselves the cypherpunks. And they were a group of people that were hoping to change the world for the better using technology. One of the words I like is technocrats. They want to bring
coming to mind that I thought you were searching for were techno-visionaries.
That works too.
But anyway.
So this person out of nowhere comes around 2008 and presents Bitcoin, which is a peer-to-peer currency. And this group of cypherpunks had no idea what to expect from this man and this digital currency, that this has actually been introduced into our economy before, the whole concept of digital currency, and it never really took off. And one of the primary reasons for that was because it always took a central authority to validate and verify and allow transactions to occur between parties. So there again, you have the central authority, like a bank, being trusted by two parties to make sure that the transaction is actually validated and verified. And so digital currency was, with the internet, we started to see in the 90s and the 2000s, the ushering in of digital currencies. As a matter of fact, right now, you and I both use digital currencies when we use our debit card or a credit card. That is a form of digital money. But again, the central authority that is verifying the transactions and that we're allowing to fractional reserve lend from our principal is these banks. These banks are already using digital technology or digital currency.
There's three technologies online that you've already hit on that enable it and what they replace. The first one is peer-to-peer networking. That means that groups of computers voluntarily join into networks without one of them being the authority, which in networking terminology is generally called the server. The individual computers,
right,
called peers, are both the client and the server. And that's an important technology that enabled Bitcoin. The second technology is cryptography, which you mentioned, you know, we trust math. Cryptography is very, very complicated math that is used to prove out that something is what it says it is. Or make it...
Right. It's not fake news, Cliff.
It's not fake news. The third, and this is really the innovation that Nakamura came up with that I hadn't heard of prior to him, was the blockchain, which is the technology that replaces a ledger. In fact,
right. I mean, it's more of just a ledger of virtually immutable status. That's really what it aims to achieve. So you brought up these clay tablets, Cliff, and how you said that they were soft and so very easily, I guess, rewritable. And when it comes to a ledger and money, you don't want a ledger to be rewritable, because that's how you get fraud. And that's how you get like a crumbling economy. So ideally, you want the ledger to remain unchangeable forever, immutable, per se. So that is what Bitcoin actually achieves. For the first time in our history, we have a digital currency that remains on a ledger that is immutable. And it's actually made immutable not by a central authority, which we've been used to, with banks and as far as history has taken us, to now an aggregate of computers that, through very clever, I believe, very clever economic and psychological engineering, are working hard to verify our transactions. And by our, I mean anybody that wishes to engage in the Bitcoin economy, be it in China, India, Russia, the U.S., anywhere. More importantly, the people that are benefiting from Bitcoin right now are actually not people in first world countries or people with bank accounts, but actually the unbanked. I believe the last time I heard, we have about 5 billion people that are unbanked, and that includes young adults, people that should already be having bank accounts. And that's kind of an egregious number when you think about, if you're going to have a working society worldwide, you would hope that they have access to the financial infrastructure that we have here, because otherwise, what are they going to be hiding their money under the bed or digging holes in the ground to hide their money? Well, that's exactly what they have.
Well, without it,
the
economy can't grow past local tribal, almost tribal status to evolve into anything more complicated or complex than that. You really do need banking. Bitcoin offers us the opportunity to very, very possibly have banking without bankers.
Yeah, and it's an entirely novel way of thinking of financial independence. So financial independence for a while has meant, or at least for as long as I've known the term, it's always meant to be able to earn enough money to both pay the bills and have enough to save in the bank account. But with the heralding of Bitcoin, now I think it means something else. And I think the implications are a lot more important. To be financially independent means that you're able to earn and send and store the money that you have worked for and not leave it to another entity to protect that money for you. So in the U.S., I think the last time we had a banking crisis was in the 20s. Was it the Great Depression, where you had the great bank runs, where you'd go into a bank and you'd try to get your money, you know, to pay your bills or whatever you had to take care of, and the bank just didn't have it. The bank just didn't have the paper
currency.
Yeah,
that was the last time that kind of banking crisis happened. Actually, I lived through the SNL crisis of the mid-80s in 1985, and I was living in a small town, and every bank in town failed that year. Savings and loans, I don't think you're old enough to even remember savings and the whole savings and loan system, which they were originally designed for people to lend money to people to buy houses, you know, to buy their homes. But then they were allowed to start investing in risky things, and you can pretty much guess what happened from there. 20 years.
No money. It goes
before the one that we've talked about extensively tonight.
You know, and I bet they heavily regulated their affairs after that crash. And there's no way that we could have ever have foreseen the 2008 crashes, right?
Mm.
That's just what I think. That's what my naivete tells me. Anyway, so getting back to the paradigm shift that I see occurring with Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, which if I could just touch on that for just an instant. When I say cryptocurrency when others say cryptocurrency, they mean that the same technology that underpins the Bitcoin currency, that can actually be used for free, by the way, to make your own digital currency. And that should be a red flag in your mind. You should be saying, well, okay, then why don't I just make my own cryptocurrency and sell it like Bitcoin? And I would invite you to try that. I think you should try to take the Bitcoin open source and make your own token, your own currency. I think that should be totally fine. What gives Bitcoin its value, however, is just
didn't one of our friends try that? I think Mark actually created a Mark coin. I don't know how well it did, but I think he actually did create one.
And see, that touches to a fundamental point about money. If Mark created these digital tokens, these currencies, and distributed them to us, if Mark actually valued them, in other words, if he was willing to allow them and accept them for, say, example, a beer at his house, or a chance to use his shower or the restroom, then there we start to see utility to his money, to his currency. But what Bitcoin has been doing for the last 8 years is building trust, decentralized trust, within the entire world. So someone in China bought a Bitcoin, and then a year later they sold it, and the market had within itself agreed that this token has value. And the network of computers, the miners that go through the work of verifying and securing the transactions, the computing system that backs Bitcoin is so huge. The Bitcoin network as of 2013 was 256 times faster than all of the top 500 supercomputers around the globe combined. Just so that it's clear, the difficulty level of and by that I mean the amount of processing power that needs to go into the Bitcoin network to validate Bitcoins, it's constantly increasing because more and more people are entering the mining profession that is backing the Bitcoin, that is validating the Bitcoin transactions, and also is the mint, if you will. So it also, the miners both verify transactions, and by that action, they are incentivized by being paid out in Bitcoin by the Bitcoin protocol. So this system self-regulates itself in a way that doesn't put all of the trust and all of the power in the hands of one person. Arguably, the only way that Bitcoin can be destroyed from the side of the mining side is if one entity comes in with so much or a cartel of so many computing so much computing power that it can overpower the system, essentially creating a 51% attack of mining power. That is one of the doomsday scenarios for Bitcoin. But the defense of the 51% attack is this. This Satoshi Nakamoto person, in creating Bitcoin, they must have really understood economics, just the philosophy of economics and psychology, because the whole point of the mechanism of the miners is to validate transactions. But in the programming, in this technology, the miners are incentivized to play fair. And if I can give you an example, if you were to play a game of football, American football, and you were to cheat, what do most people think when you've committed a foul? You've committed an error, and the ref says, "Oh, whatever past the line of scrimmage and then and threw the ball or whatever. You just throw in whatever foul. The people watching the game are not going to watch a game of football when people are allowed to cheat within the game. So with that same concept in mind, Satoshi Nakamoto created an entity, created a protocol that was self-regulating. What I mean by that is if you have one miner that tries to go out and spend more Bitcoins than he or she had, the entire network is going to throw out that person's work because the network doesn't want that person cheating and running away with money. Because you and I both know if that person's allowed to run out and cheat and spend more money than he or she has, we want to be allowed to do the same. Not everybody, when one person cuts a line in front of you, you don't just say, well, now that's going to give me the right of way to cut in front of anybody else in any other line. It just doesn't work that way. Society self-regulates that act and ostracizes you or throws you out or calls you mean names. It doesn't allow you to cheat. So this system is very much self-regulating.
I think you hit on one of the geniuses of Bitcoin and the system, and that is that you're incentivized to play by the rules. In other words, you can make more money by playing by the rules than you can by cheating, so why would you want to cheat? You don't even have to work the peer pressure of society saying that that's wrong. You just have to think in your own economic self-interest that cheating would cost me more than playing by the rules. And a system that can be set up that way has a genius of its own. You're right.
No, it's incredible. Bitcoin has been around for 8 years, and it's been running under this system, under this scheme, and it's yet to fail. In fact, something very odd happened a couple years ago where there was a large aggregate of mining power that was coming from one group of people, and they were getting very close to the 51%. And you would think, okay, if we've reached the point of no return, and let me just say really quickly why a cartel owning 51% of the processing power for verifying Bitcoins is a bad thing. If there's a high amount of processing power that's controlled by one person or one entity, then they're essentially allowed to rewrite or write the rules for all the transactions moving forward. So the way that Bitcoin works, or the way that the mining system works, just to give a quick overview of that, is you have, let's just say for the sake of simplicity, we'll use 100 computers as an example. So if 100 computers are all working on their own, what they're all trying to do is they're all trying to win Bitcoins. They're only mining because if they win, and we'll get to that in a sec, if they win the Bitcoin lottery, they'll get Bitcoins, and then they'll be allowed to sell those in the market and make money. So the way this lottery system works is it's actually a very difficult math problem that all of these computers around the world are working very hard every moment to solve. The more computers that come into this network, the more difficult that problem becomes to solve. And the reason why these computers are doing these very difficult math problems is because, and this goes back to the whole trust thing and the protocol, if a computer didn't do any work and then says, hey guys, I put together all the transactions that were broadcasted by the world, and I've put them into this little block, and I've put them at the top of the chain. In other words, saying the blockchain that I've just confirmed is the right one, or it's the one with all these working transactions. But if all these computers around the world see it, and then look at the work that it's done and say, hey, you didn't do any work. All you did was put your stamp of approval, but with no work. And this proof of work scheme is what allows Bitcoin's decentralized verification scheme to work. It is this difficult math that can't be cheated. It's like a Sudoku problem. If you do a Sudoku puzzle, you know that it's difficult to complete, but once it's been completed, it's very easy to verify. So the cryptography that goes into that, the encryption that goes into that, is what allows these computers to all agree that this computer that solved the problem is the right one to take the Bitcoins, to take the share, because that's all these computers are trying to do is verify transactions. And using that proof of work scheme is what allows them to trust that the other put the hard work into verifying the transaction and thus earning that supply of Bitcoin. So it's this give and take from the system within the protocol that really makes, I mean, this concept is very convoluted and there's a lot of moving parts here. So I hope that I'm not throwing too much at your listeners.
So
like,
we've
what
talked
the
about
world?
The blockchain is a ledger. We've talked about mining. How would you respond to those who would say, let's take this new technology and apply it in the old way with a trusted authority running and controlling the ledger, as in 100% of the ledger is controlled by one entity, which is effectively the way a bank works today?
Yeah, I think it was to be expected. To take someone else's phrase, first they ignore you, then they fight you, and then you win. And I'm sure there's another one in there that I'm missing. Do you know
I can't tell you who did it, but it's a fairly common political thinking, and it's also the thinking about any radical transformative technology. And I think that's, in fact, it probably came more from the venture capital world and transformative businesses than anything else.
Yeah, and this is exactly what we're seeing happen with Bitcoin today. It's been around for eight or nine years now. And when Bitcoin first started, it was a very niche project. Very few people knew about it. The value of a Bitcoin was about 0.0001 cents. So not even a cent was what one Bitcoin was worth. Then something strange happened. Bitcoin then had met parity with the dollar. So one Bitcoin was effectively worth $1. And I think from that moment on, the world was forever changed. And banks are very quick to understand competitors or what the competition is looking like in the horizon. And they seemed at first to dismiss Bitcoin. They thought this is a plaything. This is merely a geek's plaything, and we see no use for it. We have our money, and we understand the way money works. But slowly but surely, venture capitalists and many investors of a very very well known Andreessen. Is it Mark Andreessen? So Mark Andreessen is one of the investment capitalist firms have come in, and they've put a lot of stock in Bitcoin. And I guess in saying that, I'm not realizing my mistake. So Bitcoin isn't a stock. It's just they're just numbers. They're numbers on a digital ledger. But anyway, once banks started to see a lot of money being put into Bitcoin, they thought, well, we want to copy the same technology. We just want to use the blockchain. The blockchain's great. It's fantastic. When the banks found out that the friction that occurs within the Bitcoin blockchain, that it was very minimal, and that means that you could send $1 million or $1 to China, to India, to any country and back for just cents on the dollar. I mean, no more than 10 cents will grant you the ability to move millions and millions of dollars from one location to another. Huge. That is not a percentage. That is marginal. That is nothing. That is nothing compared to what financial institutions today would charge for that kind of money being transferred. Not to mention the amount of time that it would take to transfer that much money. It's not going to take a day. It's not going to take a week, maybe 2 weeks, if you're lucky. It also depends which banks are dealing with each other. If they're not well-known banks in some other foreign country, with a bank here, it's going to take a bit longer to actually clear that transaction. So I might have even missed that most Bitcoin transactions on average will be verified within 10 minutes. And that is huge. So again, these banks are looking at the amount of friction in their network, or rather in their clearinghouse, the way that they do finances and the way that the Bitcoin blockchain does finances. And they see a huge opportunity. They say, of course we want to take the Bitcoin technology. We want to take the blockchain technology and make it work for us. So do the exact same thing that we've been doing for all these years, except just stick blockchain technology in it and it'll work and it'll save costs and we'll make even more money. But they're missing a fundamental block to, well, sorry for the pun, but they're missing something very fundamental in the blockchain. And that's the token. That's the incentivization property that gives any blockchain any legitimacy. So what these banks are in essence trying to do is have their cake and eat it too. But what they're missing is the whole point of Bitcoin, the whole point of the Bitcoin protocol is to allow for decentralized consensus as opposed to centralized consensus. So what's really funny is that banks actually came together recently and they formed a group called R3. And they wanted to create a blockchain within just the bank's purview. And this was, I believe it was like 5 or 6 banks that came together. They're well-known banks. And they thought, we'll all be the clearinghouses of this blockchain. We'll all be the trusted authorities, all of these banks together. And we'll all just verify transactions within each other. So it'll be this way of emulating the way the blockchain works for Bitcoin, but just instead of millions and millions of miners, millions of hashes of computing being done by a bunch of anonymous computers, it'll just be 6 well-known banks. Well, I'm sorry to tell you guys, but the banks broke up. This R3 consortium broke up, and the banks decided not to push forward. They didn't necessarily say why. They didn't say that the blockchain had failed them. Rather, the paradigm that banks have been playing with or have been playing along with all this time of centralized consensus is in no way going to work with the decentralized paradigm that we see now today with Bitcoin. Banks, in coming together and trying to be the verifiers of transactions, what I believe happened was they all realized that they would have to be transparent with each other's ledgers. So Bank A would need to see exactly what was going on with Bank B's accounts. And that's not good if you're a banker, because you are beholden to your investors. And if other banks can see how much money, or in my suspicion, how little money these banks have and how close they are to insolvency, that is not good for the investor. So I think immediately these banks came together and said, you know what, let's just go our separate ways. This technology of blockchain isn't going to serve us the way we want it to, because it requires transparency. So that is something the Bitcoin blockchain allows, is any transaction is allowed to be seen by anybody in the world. Anybody, if you do wish to make yourself known, you can give people your Bitcoin account and they can see how much money you have. Banks don't want to play by those rules. So in a sense, they are just dinosaurs at this point. The whole way that Bitcoin's technology works is not in any way going to match the way that banks have been playing the financial game.
Actually, I think you've hit on something that is
up to today, I guess,
extremely fundamental. And that is that this whole idea of centralized everything is industrial age thinking. And the decentralized, highly networked environment is more the way of the new era and this podcast is about. So Bitcoin really is the currency or the monetary value for the new era. And it's even, as I was listening to you talk, I was thinking, this is bigger than just money. This is the essence of the paradigm shift. And if you want to get a deeper dive into that, I suggest you listen to some of Jordan Greenhalgh's stuff about the new networks and the way that we're organizing, not just money, but the way we're organizing as society. And this tends to mirror it. I think that almost leads us into the last part of this conversation, which is the future. The whole blockchain technology can be used for more than just money. And I thought you might have some thoughts there.
And if I could just take us back a couple of years, when the internet first came into existence, all it really was, and all it arguably still is just computers connected together and exchanging information. I thought it was very telling when there's this, I wish I remembered his name. It would be perfect to remember it right now. But he had said a while back that you shouldn't put a lot of investment into the internet, because people would quickly run out of things to say within about a month or so, and there wouldn't be anything to it. There'd be no reason to have computers connected permanently and exchanging information because humans don't have much to say to each other. And our now president would tell you that he alone could power the entirety of Twitter for about a year. Humans have so much to say, culturally, just politically, but artistically, there are things that we can express ourselves so many different ways. And the internet was a window to the world. And before, in the 60s, people didn't see the today that the internet has brought us. They just saw a nice way for two computers to share information and maybe jointly store information together and not have to buy two room-sized computers to store two Windows documents, or who knows how much information they could barely hold. But things are different now, and we've seen just how huge and incremental the internet has become in our lives. Like, you can't go a day without being affected by some application, either remotely or close by, but from the internet. So the internet is everywhere. Not to use some corny phrase, but the internet was the window to the world in terms of information. So anybody around the world that wants to communicate with me can do so on the internet. But I believe the internet was missing a very integral part, or a very integral piece, to make it whole and to really change the way, really change, I think, humanity's course. And that course, I think, is still headed in the wrong direction. But with Bitcoin, I think we see hope, because now not only can I communicate with somebody around the world, but I can actually send them money. And I can, and you would say, oh, well, just use PayPal for that. But in some parts of the world, PayPal isn't allowed to operate because our government doesn't see it as conducive to, who knows? I'm not really sure why they're not allowing PayPal to work in certain countries. And I'm sure you can think of some that those would be, but there's something fundamentally wrong with cutting off access to people and their economic power, their economic ability. If we really want to have a society worth living in, I think every man and woman should be allowed to interact with the economy. And that means being allowed to send money and receive it, more importantly, wherever they may be. So yeah, just to quickly wrap that up, in Africa, I believe they have effectively leapfrogged landlines, and now they all have cell phones. A huge percentage of people in Africa have cell phones, and guess what? Bitcoin usually works on cell phones.
Of skipping the landline concept has led some investment gurus to say that AT&T is going to become the biggest copper mine on the planet. The joke was because of the fact they're tearing up all the landlines.
Yeah,
actually, you were on an important roll.
No, that's okay.
For those of us of you who are regular listeners of this podcast, he's talking specifically about the middle layer of the abundance pyramid, particularly the information and technology communications, and talking it very passionately about how technology empowers people to participate in the economy, which in turn helps them realize their potential. I'm just underscoring that what you're saying is really fits into what the purpose of this podcast is.
Yeah, as a child, or even recently, I was never really excited about any concepts of money. I just knew that I had to earn it to pay rent. But in finding Bitcoin, there, I know that it stirs a lot of things in me, but I know that it is going to get us much closer to a free society than the current money we're using today. And I know that some people might think that it's a very it's hard hitting, and it's a very counterproductive way of solving our issues. But I do think that a fundamental concept like money needs to be as sound as possible if we're going to work as a global society. And so going back to the unbanked and to those people in Africa that don't have any access to banking, all they need is a simple cell phone with texting with a texting application, and they have now become their own bank. They have now arguably become 10 times as relevant than a bank, just one man with a cell phone. And I think the potential upside is way too big to dismiss. Bitcoin has many, many copycats, and many people might say that, oh, well, something else besides Bitcoin might come into the fray and be the better digital currency. Maybe it'll be created by a government. But I think they'd be missing the point if they thought that a centralized authority will do a better service for money than a decentralized form of verification of transactions. Because as we all know, any fiat currency that's currently in existence is running on thin ice, or they're running on a timer, because any fiat currency that's ever been created has always failed. There is not one fiat currency in existence today that has survived the test of time. And I think that would be for another day. But if I could come back to the future, and I promise, Cliff, I am trying to find a tether here to the future. Bitcoin it had to be money. So the Bitcoin blockchain, the Bitcoin protocol had to ensure that money could be moved from one person's account to another. And I say that because if the concept of money wasn't going to work on this technology, then no concept would. As everybody knows, money is the one thing that we're all trying to work for to pay the bills, to stay alive, arguably. So if money has this much power, if that concept alone wasn't going to work on this new technology that underpins Bitcoin, then there is no point in talking about this today. There's no point in talking about this in this episode. But money does work. The concept of money and the technology underpinning it does work. And that means, which this should excite many people, we're going to be able to put a lot of other concepts to run on this technology. So if I could give you an example, if you buy a piece of land, you don't have to go to the courthouse, so you don't have to go to the nearest county court to find the plat to make sure that the deed is actually going to be belonging to you, that it might maybe you were hoping for some mineral rights, and then it turns out you don't have them on the deed. So that becomes problematic when trying to do business. But if you can put all the verifiable information about that plot of land on the blockchain, then we're seeing potentially some pretty earth-shattering changes.
I want to tell you that the future is here in terms of what you were talking about in terms of property rights. I met a guy in November.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Who is actually doing that in a section of Argentina.
Okay.
He set up a block. He has an enterprise. The government has created an area of land called an enterprise zone, of which he is on the board of governors. But they are specifically using the blockchain to define property rights and register them. That is not going to be. That is actually happening in South America today.
Huh. I missed a person that we've had on our podcast who is actually working on that very concept, and in the country of Ghana, which doesn't have any of the infrastructure that we have here, absolutely none, as far as property goes. So he is trying to use Bitcoin's blockchain to plot out digitally all the land in Ghana, and the government has actually agreed to him doing this project as well. So you're right, the future is here now. And this technology is moving, like firms and many different companies that are very focused on this stuff are already building the tomorrow right now. And it's very exciting to see. It's very exciting to even know the potential. Getting back to voting, I can't stress enough how important this technology is going to be in our future. If it can verify the movement of money safely, then it can also verify voting. We might have heard a certain somebody alleging that voter fraud is rampant and that there's hacks from a certain other country that are invalidating our voting rights and justice and whatnot. But in truth, this should be a very The act of voting would be a trivial thing for the Bitcoin blockchain to protect and to verify. And if we could actually have a fair voting, if we can have an election by fair voting, it would have to run on something like Bitcoin's blockchain. we won't be seeing these. We shouldn't be seeing these sideshows.
And better than that, you can do it from your cell phone as opposed to doing.
Yeah, just think of that. Well, you can vote on your. Thank you, Cliff. See, like, well, you're just so forward thinking.
I was in my mind as I said that, I was thinking about the fact that to vote in the most recent election, I actually had to stand in a line at my precinct for an hour, you know, for my turn to vote, as opposed to doing it on a cell phone while I was I'm waiting on the next meeting to start at work. You know, how cool would that
be? Wow. Yeah.
Well, and to be fair, I was voting. I was early voting, but still.
It doesn't have to be. It should be that cool. Any active voting should not be. It should not be cumbersome. I don't think that depicts a democracy when even the act of voting itself is a burden. Yeah, this technology I hope will change.
Voting
that.
To the
it's
industrial age
for me.
Was something that you had to sacrifice for. Think about it in the civil rights movements, people of color had to risk being beaten to stand in line to vote. In Central America and South America through most of its history, it was an act of bravery to stand in line because dying, you know, catching a bullet. So the idea that that voting should be hard and difficult is an industrial age thought. It is industrial age thinking. It should be simple. It should be something you can do on a cell phone. I find it very fascinating that we kind of lagged as we talked about the history and the present. But it's when we started talking about the future that we started getting really excited. And that's as it should be. This any new technology and the opens us up to possibilities. The excitement is in the possibilities. So I'm glad we're talking about this mostly, at least a big chunk of it, in from the perspective of possibilities. I wanted to get your final thoughts, and feel free to do a shameless self-promotion of yourself.
Thanks, Cliff. I think this podcast, Cliff's podcast, is important to me because it stresses the independence in more ways than just the financial. But if you're going to understand what independence means, I think it's important to understand what you're trying to free yourself from. And for a long time, I never necessarily understood what was true money. And in studying this technology that is Bitcoin and the digital currency, I have learned a lot more of what money is in 4 years than I've learned my entire lifetime. I think for now, in the immediate future, the media is going to be portraying Bitcoin as something to be wary of, something to be afraid of. But please don't be. I actually invite you to be more skeptical than anything. Assume that Bitcoin will fail. And I say that because the potential upside of this technology is incredible. I could not even fathom it. The same way people in the 70s and 60s couldn't fathom what the internet would become today. I invite you to look into Bitcoin yourself. We do have a website to do that. We are actually building it right now. So unfortunately, I can't give that to you. But what I will give you is my podcast website. And all you have to do is go to SoundCloud at BLibre Podcast, and you'll find it on SoundCloud. So what I'll do is I'll send Cliff a link, and maybe he can put it on his podcast description. But what we do is we just talk about Bitcoin. I think it's the future. I think it is the much needed shift of. I will say that we had the separation of church and state. I believe that the separation of money and state is the next potential outcome of this impending paradigm shift. When money is no longer in control of the few, I think it empowers the many. And Bitcoin is a way to very elegantly do that. And it's elegant because it's by mathematics. I'm not telling you to trust me. Just trust the math. That's really all you have to do. But yeah, Cliff, thank you so much for having me on and talking about Bitcoin. I feel like I've barely just scratched the surface of this technology, but I hope that people will take it and learn.
Yeah,
learn about
thanks
it
for coming
and
on. And I think we had a good conversation about the past, present, and future. So, and hopefully it will get people excited to check out this technology and see how it can empower you. So I wanted to talk about, before I close, I want to talk about some upcoming events. On February 17th, here in San Antonio, I'll be involved in a visioning workshop. Watch the Debt Hacker for more details. Also, I'm going to be co-hosting the Conscious Media Festival in Austin in March 3rd, 4th, and 5th. So there's another opportunity. Everybody come on out, and I'd love to meet you in person. So our next show will be on February 21st, and my guest will be healer, traveler, and adventurer, Dr. Kieran Kirkendall. I'm really excited to talk to him because he's always a fascinating guy. Thanks for joining us.
I'm so grateful you chose to spend this time with me. Remember that every one of us builds this new era one choice at a time. Start living now like it's already here. Commit a random act of kindness this week. Make healthy, sustainable choices. Choose peace. Choose abundance. Then celebrate your progress and passion. It is important to know that the future is in your hands. You create it through the choices you make in the now. See you next week.